Lecture 30, American Dialects in Literature.
Hello, and welcome back to American Regionalism. In this lecture, I'm going to follow up on some of the things I noted in my last lecture on American regional dialects. And I'm going to concentrate on the literary representation of American regional dialects. Now, before I do so, and before I read the passages that I'm going to use as examples of the literary representation of dialect, I want to offer up a little caveat. Very often, the literary representation of dialect is used for humorous purpose. We saw this, in fact, in Middle English, in Chaucer's Reeve's Tale, and we saw it in the second Shepherd's Play. But it's important to stress that the literary representation of dialect here, and my use of these texts, is not meant to make fun of, to mock, or to deride regional speakers, speakers who identify themselves by class, or speakers who identify themselves by ethnic group. Rather, my goal is to see how literary representations of dialects may be understood philologically on the one hand and critically on the other hand. We need to ask certain questions, it seems to me, not just about how accurate these texts are, but why they proliferate in American writing of the 19th and 20th centuries. What the relationship is between eye dialect and the sound of speech, how we can use such resources of lexicography as the Dictionary of American Regional English to understand them, and finally, what are some of the ideological or political issues raised by the literary representation of American dialects. With these caveats in mind, let me go through a few issues in dialectology and literary dialect representation. Eye dialect is a term I've used in earlier lectures to describe not the accurate phonological representation of a dialect. In other words, not the transcription of a sound, but rather the evocation of a sound or the evocation of a class or level of speech or literacy. As I've mentioned, writing says, S-E-Z, or wanna, W-A-N-N-A, does not tell us anything really about pronunciation. Rather, such spellings tell us about what the writer thinks is the educational or social level of the speaker. In other words, how the speaker might potentially write the words rather than say them. Comedy is an issue as well. What is funny? Exaggeration? Or level of speech, or the exotic, or the rare, is very often humorous in dialect representations of literature. Dialect representation in literature, let us say, is the verbal equivalent of caricature. Caricature works through exaggeration. Dialectology sometimes works through exaggeration here as well. And in my last lecture, I ended by raising the question of the moral or the ethical content of the study of dialect. Is the dialect speaker a quote-unquote natural human? Someone not affected, let us say, by the corruptions of civilization? Is the American soul or the American spirit to be found not in the city, but in the country? Not in the broad span of the American continent, but in the small confines of the region? Is the heart of America to be found, in other words, in such details of regional action, speech, dress, and behavior? The representation of dialect in American literature, I would like to suggest, has a distinctively American historical edge to it, for it dovetails with earlier American rhetorical notions of natural expression and unadorned speech. So let's try and see these passages and these discussions in the larger contexts of American literary history, American language, and American culture. And I want to begin with perhaps the most famous figure in the literary representation of dialect, Mark Twain. Mark Twain is very well known for his attempts accurately and sympathetically to represent the regional speech of those individuals of the Missouri area where he grew up. He very often represents the language of the white and the African-American speakers of the area in the Mississippi Basin. Twain, writing in the 1880s, ensconced in Connecticut, looks back to the time and the place of his childhood. And there is, to some degree, a nostalgic quality to Twain's representation of dialect. This notion of Twainian nostalgia may also inflect our notion of dialect and may take us back to this notion of the natural or the American. In other words, not only are we looking at differences of space, we're looking at differences of time. Is the true American self to be found in the region rather than in the city or in the nation at large? But also, is the true American self to be found at the time of our childhood? Whether it's the childhood of the 1840s for Twain, or, in my case, the childhood of the 1950s and 60s in Brooklyn. I think we all want to find a moment when we originally spoke. And for Twain and Huckleberry Finn, there is a quality to that in the sound of Tom and Huck and Jim. And I want to read a little passage from Huckleberry Finn to illustrate Twain's representation of the Missouri dialect. So Tom says, and here's the quotation, "I know how to fix it. We've got to have a rock for the coat of arms and mournful inscriptions, and we can kill two birds with that same rock. There's a gaudy big grindstone down at the mill, and we'll smooch it and carve the thing on it and file out the pens and the saw on it, too." And Huck responds, "It warn't no slouch of an idea, and it warn't no slouch of a grindstone, nother. But we allowed we'd tackle it. It warn't quite midnight yet, so we cleared out for the mill, leaving Jim at work. We smooched the grindstone and set out to roll her home, but it was a most nation-tough job. Sometimes, do what we couldn't keep her from falling over, and she come mighty near mashing us every time. Tom said she was going to get one of us, sure, before we got through. We got her halfway, and then we was plumb played out and most drowned with sweat. We see it warn't no use, we got to go and fetch Jim. So he raised up his bed and slid the chain off the bed leg and wrapped it round around his neck, and we crawled out through our hole and down there, and Jim and me laid into that grindstone and walked her along like nothing, and Tom superintended. He could out-superintend any boy I ever see. He knowed how to do everything." Now, I think I've more or less accurately represented the sound of Twain as filtered through Huck. And it's clear in this passage that there's more I dialect in Huck's speech than there is in Tom's speech. When we look grammatically at this text, we're looking at certain examples of regional or folk speech. Warn't for weren't. Nother, N-U-T-H-E-R, for neither. Wrapped, W-R-A-P-T, for the word W-R-A-P-P-E-D. Wrapped, spelled that way, is pure I dialect. It doesn't tell us much about pronunciation. It tells us about a category of literacy or folk use. Morphology. Let's look at verbs. Drowned, knowed, the use of this, what we might call multiple past, instead of the participial forms. But listen to the story also that was told here, and you hear what we might call an oscillation between a narrative past and a present. I'd like to suggest that it's this oscillation, in other words, this variation between telling the story as something that's happened and as something that's happening now, it's this oscillation that creates certain grammatical ambiguities. In other words, can we really say that there's a difference between I see and I saw? He could out-superintend any boy I ever see. Now, is this a question of regionalism and dialect, or is it a question of narrative voice? Or look at the word like superintend. It's clear that what Twain is doing is he is placing first a heightened, elevated word in the mouth of Huck. Tom superintended. But then what Huck does is he takes what he imagines to be a correct or hypercorrect form, but which in fact is a coinage or a neologism. He could out-superintend any boy I ever see. He knowed, instead of knew, how to do everything. The apparent learning of Huck is undercut by the regionalism of the grammar. Look at words like smooch for steal, for snitch, or snatch, perhaps. Nation, tough job. Tarnation, clearly a regional euphemism for damnation. Instead of saying it was a damn tough job, what you say is it's a damnation tough job, so you get a new euphemism, a nation tough job. Mighty near, plum played out. These are the landmarks of regionalism which make define Twain's Missouri speech, as he's recalling it, but which also evoke in the mind of the standard American reader, the Hartford reader, the New England reader, the educated reader, just what constitutes the folk. Twain's language is representative, but it is also evocative. Now let's look at a more complex and more challenging example of the representation of regional dialect. Joel Chandler Harris gained fame in the 1880s for the publication of the Uncle Remus stories. In these stories, Harris collected the folk tales and narratives of the African Americans of the mid and late 19th century, and they eventually became the basis for such popular phenomena as the Disney movie Song of the South. Harris's work has come under great scrutiny by contemporary American and African-American readers and writers, and there is a general and, I think, genuine question at work here as to how representative Harris is of speech and tone and dialect. I think it's worth looking at Harris, however, in the terms that we used to look at Twain, as an example of folk speech, as an example of regionalism, and also as a challenge to our own presuppositions as to what constitute literary narrative. I'm going to read a passage here from the language of Joel Chandler Harris in the story known as A Run of Luck. "Well, sir," he said after a while, "I come mighty nigh gwine off with my young master. I expect I'd gone if he'd had any children. But he ain't had a blessed one. And it looked like ter me such that if the Lord gwine ter stand by a man, he gwine ter give him children. But that ain't all, sir. I done been out toward Mississippi with my young master. And that one time was too much for me. First, there was the rip it on the steamboat. And then there was the burning of the boat. And then come the swamps. And then the cane breaks. And I'll tell you right now, sir, I dunno which was the wuss. The rip it on the boat, or the fair, or the swamps, or the cane breaks. That ain't no country like Kern, sir. There's enough water in the state of Mississippi for to float Noah's Ark. Hit in the valley and what they plant the cotton in, sir, the ground is mushy and black. You mayn't believe me, sir, but there was times when I was out there that I'd have paid 7 pence for to give a whiff of dish your red dust up my nose. When you come to farming, sir, give me the red line or the gray. It may not make as much cotton in one season, but it lasts longer, and it's a lot more wholesome." This is a very challenging passage, and I want to look at it in some detail to ask precisely where the challenges are. What is the sound of this? What is being represented here? The dropping of R in S-U-H for suh instead of sir, but the intrusion of a post-vocalic R in marster instead of master. I done been is, as we will see in a subsequent lecture on African-American English, perhaps not an illiterate or ungrammatical phrase, but something perfectly consonant with the grammar of African-American English, which uses durative aspects rather than tenses, issues which distinguish, or grammatical issues which distinguish, action that has been ongoing or durative. Mississippi is reduced to Mississippi. The phonology of TH becoming D in day, but also what we might call a hypercorrection of it becoming hit. But it seems to me the most interesting feature of this passage is not really in pronunciation, but in vocabulary. The word that appears here repeated to describe a particular kind of plant is canebrake. And when I read this passage for the first time, I didn't know what a canebrake was. So I went to the Dictionary of American Regional English. And I looked it up under break, noun, canebrake, a thicket, especially of a single kind of vegetation, the land often low and wet on which such thickets grow, chiefly in the South and the South Midlands. Canebrake, the first reference to the word canebrake in the Dictionary of American Regional English, is from 1770. There is a large neck or island of swamp or canebrake land. 1810, he saw that the whole country was an entire canebrake. 1836, a quotation, Indian corn is commonly obtained from the prairie canebrake lands. Canebrakes, in fact, the word is adduced well up until the 1970s, supplementing this forage with the canebrakes, dense patches of cane that occurred along many of the rivers and smaller streams of the South, especially in Alabama and the Mississippi. What does this entry from the Dictionary of American Regional English tell us about Joel Chandler Harris? What it tells me is that the word canebrake is being used here as a unique and distinctive phrase to locate time and place. It's a way of representing precisely a geographical or a vegetative feature that exists only in a particular area. And it enhances the representation of sound and speech. Let me also say something about the narrative of this passage. As in the Twain passage, dialect is not just a question of pronunciation or grammar, but a question of narration. Are you telling a story in the past, or are you telling it in the present? Present tense narration of past events, what we might call a continuous or ongoing present, is very often a feature of regional or folk narrative, the way we tell tales. The way we tell tales is we tell stories about things that happened a long time ago, but we tell them in a kind of continuous narrative present. Well, here, in this passage, it seems to me, there is a kind of biblical quality to the narrative. I talked about the Bible in Frederick Douglass. I talked about the Bible in Lincoln. I talked about the Bible in Melville in 19th century American speech and writing. And the Bible here, I think, infuses the tone of the narrative with its repeated or paratactic beginnings, with the couplers that begin each of the sentences, with the sense that what we're getting at is not simply a description of an event on a steamboat, on a river, but almost an allegory of experience, something which is the regional dialect equivalent of Frederick Douglass's story of the escaped slaves. Now, let's look at a passage from Sarah Orne Jewett. Sarah Orne Jewett lived in Maine, and her story, Andrew's Fortune, represents one of the key examples of the Maine or Down East dialect in the late 19th century. I'll read this passage. This is a discussion between two people. "We was dreadful concerned to hear our cousin Stephen's death," said the poor man. "It went very sudden, didn't it? Great loss he is." "Yes," said Betsy. "He was very much looked up to." And it was some time before the heir plucked up the courage to speak again. "Wife and me was lotting on getting over to the funeral, but it's a great ways for her to ride. And it was a perishing day that day. She's been troubled more than common with her physic since cold weather come. I was all crippled up with the rheumatism. We weren't neither of us fit out to be." Plaintively. "'Twas all I could do to get to the barn to feed the stock while Thomas and Jim were gone. The boys was over, I suppose you know. I don't know they come to speak with thee, but they're backward with strangers. But they're good, stiddy fellows. Them was the louts that was hanging around the barn, I guess," said Betsy to herself. "They're the mainstay now, They're ahead of poor me already, Jonas. He's got our eyes on $100 laid up. And I believe Tim's got something, too. He's younger, you know. Okay, what's going on in this passage? Here, we see I dialect used to indicate certain sounds. Great, spelled G-R-E, apostrophe T, is an I dialect way of indicating that you wouldn't say great, but you'd say great, great. Now, the apostrophe indicates a missing letter in writing, but it doesn't indicate a missing sound, like doesn't or can't. It's not really a contraction, but it's a kind of homespun way of representing the sound of the language. Similarly, bin, B-E-E-N, is represented B-E apostrophe N, a bit of I dialect here. Look at the technical language. Just as in Twain, the use of a highly technical term is an indication of attitude and dialect and region. And here, it's physic, spelled P-H-T-H-I-S-I-C, which sounds like a mispronunciation of physic, but is in fact the regional word for asthma. Her physic since the cold weather come. That's what makes sense out of this passage. She's got asthma, and I was all crippled up with the rheumatism. Not with rheumatism, the rheumatism. The use of a definite article before a technical term, like an illness, is very often a marker of folk or regional speech. It's a kind of hyper-correction, in some sense. This example of the main dialect, in some sense, is also an example of characteristically American speech historically. Wife and me was lotting on getting over to the funeral. One of the things that British visitors to the United States noticed as early as the early 19th century was the use of the verb lot as a distinctive Americanism. To bet, to count on, to draw lots. In fact, it's a word of great antiquity. For Old English and for the older Scandinavian languages, the lot is the drawing. It is the hap. It is the chance. Something like Sarah Orne Jewett's representation of Maine speech can also productively be seen in contrast with the other representation of dialect I will read, also by a woman writer now of the 20th century. And this is Marjorie Kinman Rawlings. Marjorie Kinman Rawlings is best known for The Yearling, and in her story, My Friend Mo, she illustrates the language of North Florida, of the panhandle, of what is perhaps derisively known as cracker speech, the language of the relatively uneducated white regional population of this area. As he worked, he noticed a row of glass jars of huckleberries that I had canned. His grave face brightened. "Now that's the way to live," he said. "All the good things we've got here in Florida, blueberries and blackberries and beans and cowpeas, all them things had ought to be canned and put up on a clean cupboard shelf with white paper on it. That's the way my ma did. She lived fine, not the way you live, but just as good when it comes to canning things and keeping them clean." His face darkened. "I've tried and I've done tried to get my wife to do that away, but it just ain't no use. One time I brought 2 dozen glass jars and I went out by myself and I picked about a bushel of blackberries and I went to the store and bought a 25-pound sack of sugar and I taken it home and I said, 'Wife, here's a bed of blackberries to put up for us for jam and jelly for the winter.'" He hesitated, his loyalty pricking him. "She probably didn't have time to do it," I suggested. "She had time. She let the blackberries spoil. And the ants has gotten the sugar, and I found the jars thrown out in the backyard." Now, this story, with its extreme version of dialect, hinges, I want to suggest, not just on a caricature of pronunciation, but on particular grammatical features. Let's look at them in some detail. Come to canon things and keeping things clean. Is this a question of pronunciation or is this a question of grammar? is this a version or a variant of an old strong verb, come, came, in some sense, when it come to canning things. A word like cow peas, we can look up in the Dictionary of American Regional English, and we see that it means black-eyed peas. And the earliest citation is from 1776 for cow peas, a very old Americanism. I've tried and I've done tried. Is this a case of regional speech filtered through the uneducated, or in fact, is this really a question of grammaticalization? In African American English, as we will see, it has been argued that there is a past and a durative past. I've tried and I've done tried. Is this a case simply of emphasis, or is it a case of two different tenses? In other words, I've tried. Action initiated and completed in the past, I've done tried. Action initiated in the past and perhaps repeated, ongoing, maybe still a feature of the action. That-a-way, classic regionalism, not simply located in Florida, but a marker of the regional. This-a-way and that-a-way. O apostrophe for of, indicating the elision in regional speech. Here's a bait of blackberries. Look up bait in the Dictionary of Regional English. A large amount, an ample portion of, or all that you can eat. And the Dictionary of American Regional English cites references to North Carolina, Georgia, and Florida, but also, interestingly, it cites an example from Marjorie Kennan Rawlings from The Yearling, published in 1938. So here, Rawlings becomes a literary set of examples, evidence for regional speech that the lexicographer will use. The ants is got in the sugar, and I found the jars throwed out in the backyard. I used ANSYS as an example in my previous lecture of a good regionalism, something that the Dictionary of American English records as a regional variant because it is grammatically different. I would like to close this lecture and this brace of lectures on American regional English by thinking about this particular story, not just as a tale of a man who can't get his wife to can fruit, but as a tale of the place of the regional in American literature and culture. The ants got in the sugar. Let's take the ants getting in the sugar as the question of American regional English getting in the sugar of the American language. Rawlings is telling us a story of how regional English becomes or overtakes our everyday speech. In all the passages I've read, you can see examples of people trying to do things and failing. You can see examples of people trying to tell stories and encountering impediments or tragedy or everyday disappointment. American regional literature often takes as its subject matter the disappointment, the accomplishment failed, the occasion of everydayness. The answer is getting in the sugar is now the way in which, or an example of the way in which, the sound of American regional English not just gets in and spoils the sugar, maybe it becomes the sugar. Do we throw out the jars in the backyard, or should we line up these jars now on our shelf and admire what they have become, and recognize that in the literary representation of American dialect, we may see comedy, but we should not see derision. We may see wit, but we should not see mockery. What we see is the American language now as a brace, a clutch, a constellation of regional forms that displace the sugar of our speech with the beautifully moving, formican features of the ants of sound and sense. Thank you.